The Vulture TV podcast is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Casper mattresses come with free delivery and returns within a 100-day period. And right now, get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/vulture. That's casper.com/vulture. Promo code VULTURE. This episode is also brought to you by Harrys.com. When did shaving get so expensive? Go to Harrys.com and Harrys will give $5 off to Vulture TV podcast listeners. Type in the code VULTURE at checkout for $5 off the starter set. Start shaving smarter today. This episode is also sponsored by Hulu. Seinfeld. Check out every moment, every episode, now streaming on Hulu.com.
The following podcast contains spoilers. Check the episode description to see the exact times of the segments that contain spoilers.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Vulture TV podcast. I'm Gazelle Amami, Vulture's TV editor, and I'm here with TV columnist Margaret Lyons and TV critic Matt Zoller Seitz. How are your weekends, guys?
Pretty good.
I ate a lot of meat this weekend. Chicken, sausage, hamburgers. Very patriotic.
Did you watch any television?
I actually started binge-watching Seinfeld again because my daughter is watching it for the first time.
Oh, that must be fun.
It is, and actually it was funny because the soundtrack to the last 4 days has been the baseline of the Seinfeld baseline. How about you?
I have been watching a lot of TV. I think the biggest surprise for me this week was the most recent episode of Halt and Catch Fire. Mm-hmm. I think the show has been, we've talked about this before, on sort of a creative upswing. This episode was sort of a mixed bag for me, but it did have really, really strong moments from Donna, who is obviously the best character on that show. And she had a really great episode. And I like seeing her have highs and lows. And, you know, so she's in the throes of a pregnancy crisis. Seems like she gets an abortion on this episode, although we don't see her technically go through with it.
Right.
So who knows? Dramas are like sometimes tricky about that. But I really like the scene where she just like breaks down crying in a meeting. And she's furious and she's also overwhelmed and she doesn't know, but we know that her husband is very ill or is about to be very ill. Mm-hmm. And we just see her sort of in this real state of turmoil and it's always interesting to see like when a character gets to their breaking point, what does that look like and how does that break them and in what ways, right? And some people throw stuff and some people become catatonic and whatever. And so to see, oh, this is what it looks like when we really see Donna break.
And it's amazing to see her like alternate between strength and vulnerability. And in that scene, when she starts crying, I just had no idea what she was going to do next. And that's what made it interesting to me.
Me too. I thought, because it seemed like for a second, she might just be like, fuck this. Like,
exactly.
Forget everything. Like, I'm going to fall onto the floor and just be mm-hmm. over it. And then she sort of like composes herself and she doesn't stop crying, but she does start talking. I just thought it was great.
Yeah.
Even though I did not think this episode was that good.
She was the highlight.
She's always the highlight. She's the best part of that show.
It's a really good example of a show finding itself in its second season, though.
Sure, yeah.
I think for the most part, yeah.
Gazelle, did you have a favorite TV?
Yeah, I've really been enjoying AMC's new show, Humans, which was originally a British show that recently came over. And Sunday night was the second episode, and I really like the dynamic between the mom and basically the show is about like this alternate future, I believe, where households can have like a robot that looks like a human to do the housework and help around with whatever needs help. And the mom in this family is really creeped out by the synth, as they're called, that they have in their house, who seems like maybe she has more consciousness, more awareness than a robot should. There's constantly scenes of the mother getting spooked out by this synth. I forget her name.
Anita,
yes. And there was a scene where Anita had her hands closed and there was a spider inside of her hands. And the mom is like, how did you know I was afraid of spiders? And then she catches her staring at her in the mirror. And it just like every little moment is like a little horror movie-esque, but a little comical as well. And I just really enjoy watching their dynamic and it keeps me on my toes.
It's cool too, because the rest of the family is like, no.
Yeah,
mom,
they seem like
you're
idiots.
Yes.
But there's also like this tension because, you know, the mom is like away for work a lot. And so she has like some guilt about that. And then the husband sort of guilt trips her and is like, well, if you were here, we wouldn't need a robot. There's like the robot is also, the synth is also like a referendum. It's not just like, here's creepy robot shit. Like, I think the show does a really good job of
that was the original title.
But I think, it's one of the things that I think sci-fi dramas can do really, really well is creating stand-ins for whatever sort of emotional crises characters are going through. And we have Anita, who we learn has like a previous life as a other synth named Mia. She represents certain things to certain characters, not just what does it mean to be in a technologically advanced society, but also like, how do I relate to people? What do I do when I'm an outsider in my family? Like, what is my relationship to domesticity, right? Mm-hmm. And having a robot character there that's able to sort of reflect and power through those ideas.
Right.
I think the show is really, really That's, cool.
It's an example of that thing we were talking about last week, where some of the most interesting TV shows are ones that have that kind of an element that take otherwise ordinary situations and lift them out of their usual context and make them fresh again. And that's what science fiction
like
is.
With Catastrophe.
Catastrophe is that mm-hmm. way, and a lot of the other shows you talked about. But ideally, that's what science fiction is supposed to be about, but it often isn't. You know, mm-hmm. I'm always so excited when I see what I call real science fiction, which is about the things you're talking about, Margaret. And so much of what is built as science fiction is what I call science fiction flavored product. You know, like it's just like it's eye candy, or it's like the same stupid action or cop thriller or horror movie stuff that you get too much of already. But there's a little layering of science fiction to production design on top of it. And this is not like that.
I like when shows take their idea and really make it about something more than just, oh, there's like a robot in your house, right? And there's like a bunch of ways to navigate what that kind of story could be. And I just think the show, at every opportunity to make emotional choices, it makes the most emotional choice. And that is really exciting in a drama.
So this episode, we're going to discuss hate watching TV shows. And then we'll talk about Sunday night's episode of True Detective, and we'll end with
segue maybe intentional.
We shall see. And then we'll finish up our discussion of Orange is the New Black's third season. If you have any questions for us, please email us at tvquestions@vulture.com. We'll be back to talk about hate watching TV shows in a moment, but first, a word from our sponsor.
The Vulture TV podcast is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing the savings directly to the customer. Prioritize your precious TV hours by skipping the hall to a grody mattress showroom and order from Casper so you can get yourself a perfect mattress for TV watching in bed. Casper mattresses are obsessively engineered and sold at a shockingly fair price. They have just the right sink and just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. Casper has a risk-free trial and return policy. You can try sleeping on a Casper mattress for 100 days. There's free delivery and painless returns. Casper mattresses are also made in America. We've mentioned the shockingly low prices, and get ready to be shocked. Casper mattresses are $500 for a twin and $950 for a king. Compare that to the industry averages. That's an outstanding price. Vulture TV podcast listeners, that's you, can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/vulture and using the promo code VULTURE.
So hate watching TV shows for the unfamiliar is basically what it sounds like, which is watching shows that you hate despite the fact that you hate them. Jezebel had defined it as the act of watching a show you claim to dislike with the sole purpose of mocking it. I don't know that it's for the sole purpose of mocking it, because it feels like you're getting some enjoyment out of it as well. Margaret, you mentioned it seemed to be a really hot topic about 2 or 3 years ago, where it was kind of applied to TV shows that were maybe more trying to be prestigious but not pulling that off, like The Newsroom.
Newsroom and Smash felt like the big sort hate watches of recent memory.
Yeah.
And I say this as somebody who watched every episode of both of those shows. And not just for work. Like, there are shows that I continue to watch for work. But, like, my professional responsibilities for those shows did not include watching every single episode. But I totally did.
I don't really usually hate watch shows in that way. I'm sort of more like hope watching them, but maybe hating them while I'm hope watching them. Like, hoping they'll get better. There are shows that frustrate me, but I can't think of too many that I really, really hate that I would watch all the time, because that just seems like counterproductive to me.
Do you think the term kind of stemmed from people being embarrassed by what they watched and wanting a way to talk about it without really liked it?
Very much so. Absolutely. I was always skeptical of that term, honestly. Like, if you're watching something every single week, you like it. There are certain shows, like Margaret was talking about, things that you sort of have to keep tabs on if you're mm-hmm. a TV critic, because they're just such a part of the conversation. But I don't necessarily take a lot of pleasure in, like, Walking Dead. I kind of feel like if that was a relationship, I would have ended it by now.
I feel like I watch The Walking Dead out of professional commitment because it's a show that's important to a lot of our readers, and it's an extremely popular show, and I don't care for it at all. But there's a very different sensation when I watch that versus when I watch Smash. That's
right.
And I think the term that's the easiest is hate watch. I get why that's an imprecise term, but like, I don't like The Walking Dead, but the Smash's failures, like, consumed me. Like, I was fascinated by them and like loved watching it suck, kind of, and like, oh, they're gonna, like, they're walking down a bad path right now. And like, as frustrated as I get with Walking Dead, and as often as I'm like, the next time someone has a good idea will be the first time anyone on the show has ever had a good idea, like, it's like, I don't know, let's go back to the woods. It's like, fucking stop. Like, like, no, like, start growing vegetables, like, holy shit. But like, let's strategize. But like, however irritating I find that show, like, it's nothing compared to the sort of thrall of the newsroom, where it was just like, there is no thing this show can do that won't in some capacity fascinate me.
And then it's pushing your buttons more.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
There's something really exquisitely painful about a show like that, where, you know, the production values are good, the direction is good, the cast is quite good, but every time they get close to something that's actually really just completely good, they blow it. They always blow it. And it's like, I often feel like Walking Dead has that aspect as well. There's some really excellent filmmaking on that show. Like, even in bad episodes, there'll be something that I think is quite well done. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't last very long. And then it's back to the, you know, the usual crap. Oh my God.
I think maybe part of it is what you were saying about like shows that are trying to be prestigious. And I think anytime a show has a sense of like self-congratulatory crap around it, like, especially
a crap halo,
especially newsroom, but like sometimes on Smash you could feel like, oh, this is when a slow clap they think is like gonna, it's like, yes, finally someone is like telling us, and it was just like, oh no, this is like so dumb, I can't even handle like how dumb this is. And so like that feeling, that what especially up against like a show that's like, please now like shower us with your applause. Like, there's something, I don't know.
Well, we mentioned the newsroom again. I think we all maybe kind of missed that a little bit, as kind of stubbed toe every week as it was, but I feel like Aaron Sorkin is kind of the king of that sort of sensation. Like, like, everybody talks about how, you know, how much they missed The West Wing and how great it was. But I remember watching The West Wing, and even during really good episodes, there were always several moments and several individual scenes where I was kind of watching through the cracks in my fingers because it sucked. I mean, it was really like they would do something.
I will
like,
go to the mat. No. Yes. So I couldn't disagree.
Okay, battle.
No, West Wing is not a hate watch.
No, it was often a disappointment watch for me, though, because it was so, there were some great episodes, but there were a lot of episodes where I felt like they grasped greatness and then threw it against the nearest wall, you know? I mean, that's a Sorkin thing.
I mean, I think Studio 60 is a hate watch also.
Oh, God.
So, like, West Wing is not a hate watch for me. Although, that said, I never rewatch seasons 5 and 6 because that's just horrendous.
Well, once Sorkin leaves, what's the point?
Although I think season 7 is viable. Like, season 7 is a good season of another show.
Yeah.
It's not, like, the same West Wing that you love, but it's another West Wing, and you can love it also. But 5 and 6 is just garbage town. But Studio 60 is, like, is the same kind of, like, please now, like, honor us with, and it's so, I don't know, bloated, self-aggrandizing, like really, really out of touch with its own perceived greatness.
These are synonyms for Sorkin, you realize.
Right, but I say this as somebody who, like, my desert island show is Sports Night. Like, that's my favorite show
ever. Sports Night's wonderful. Even Sports Night
has some missteps.
It had its insufferable moments, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, there's plenty of missteps in there.
So I think we've determined that Sorkin is the king of the hate watch.
But, but it's weird because there are way, way worse shows.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, right. I think Studio 60 was really bad. I think The Newsroom was real bad. But those are not the worst shows I've ever seen. They're not the worst shows of their season. They're often not even the worst shows that were airing that night. But somehow there's, like, a magnetism to them.
You know what show I actually did hate watch was 2.5 Men.
Oh, God.
I did. Ugh. I did sometimes watch it because it was so, there was an awful fascination to it because I felt like I was... Boy, what an East Coast elitist I am. I felt like I was staring into the dark heart of America when I watched that show. Like the fact that, you know, Charlie Sheen was the hero. He was the hero of that show.
Pre-Ashton Kutcher.
Yeah. Once Charlie Sheen was gone, it was like when Sorkin left the West Wing. Mm-hmm. What was the point? You know, but he was like a vampire. I really felt like in my mind I was watching a show about a vampire. Charlie Sheen's character was he was like the Prince of Darkness on that show, and everyone adored him. Two and a Half Men will always be associated in my mind with an ex-girlfriend's dad who came up to me one time and said, you know what show is really, really good? And I said, what? And he said, Two and a Half Men. That's some high-quality comedy, don't you think?
Oh, no.
And it was like, what am I supposed to say to that? And he and I said, it's something else. Like, I gave some kind of a noncommittal answer, and then he came back, like, a few conversations later and like, you know, I was watching Two and a Half Men again. Boy, oh boy, is that a good show. And then he'd look at me expectantly. And it became clear that at some point I was going to have to say, yes, Two and a Half Men is a good show. Otherwise, it was going to create issues. So that's what I had to do. I think I started faking hearing impairment at a certain point. Two and a Half Men, isn't that a great show? I'm sorry, I can't understand what you're saying.
But also, I can't understand what you're saying. I'm baffled, sir.
Yes, exactly.
Like, every once in a while, I'll watch a Two Broke Girls, and it'll have that same feeling of like, there's a horrendous underbelly that is like, oh God, I live in a nation of strangers. Like, who's watching this? How can anyone? This is like really demoralizing.
I feel like that a lot of times when I watch the Super Bowl halftime shows, you know, like not all of them. Like, I thought Madonna was amazing, but the one where Aerosmith was playing and they had like astronauts on top of a junk pile and jets flying overhead and stuff like that. And it was like, wow.
I feel like we're getting into like Man Shouts at Cloud territory now.
Yeah, we are. We really are. But that's my, you know, that was my birth name. I changed it. I changed it to something a little easier to say.
Well, we'll be back to talk about True Detective in just a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor.
This episode of the Vulture TV podcast is brought to you by Harry's.com. What would you do with all of the money you're saving by shaving with Harry's? Harry's starter kit is just $15. That includes the razor, three blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or foaming shave gel. As a bonus, you can get $5 off your first purchase with the code VULTURE. That's V-U-L-T-U-R-E. After using the promo code, you can get an entire month's worth of shaving for just $10. That's HARRYS.com, promo code VULTURE. Start shaving smarter today.
So speaking of hate watching, True Detective, the second season has gotten a fair bit of flack. And I think Nick Pizzolatto, is the creator, is starting to become a little reviled in that kind of way that we were talking about with Sorkin.
He's kind of turning into the hairy-chested Sorkin, although I guess Sorkin is the hairy-chested Sorkin. I don't know.
I don't think it has anything to do with chestedness.
I'm going for a machismo thing, and it's failing. I apologize.
You don't write the profile of yourself. Obviously, like, the people who write profiles of Nick Pizzolatto are complacent in this, like, weird positioning of him as this, like, man's man of man TV or whatever. That said, he hasn't disputed the accuracy of any of the quotes, so... like, these are things that he said about himself. And I think, like, at a certain point, it just seems really ungracious to be like, well, look, if everyone wants to call me a hero, I guess I am. Which, right? No, and that's not a direct
Vanity
quote.
Fair profile.
Yeah, but I also, and like, in a variety of other profiles, you know, he's right. Like, he's not somebody who's short on confidence.
Certainly not. No. You know, neither was Norman Mailer. And not that, God forbid, I'm comparing him to Mailer, because I'm not. But, you know, I'm saying there are certain types of people who just come right out and say, yeah, I'm the shit. And you see that, and they tend to end up in magazines like Vanity Fair.
I mean, I'm not asking for, like, showrunners to sort of be humbled before us. I don't think that makes sense. And again, like, who knows what kinds of quotes didn't make it into the interview. And if you're framing it as that, we've all said things that in whatever context will suddenly seem really pretentious or, I don't know, irritating. Mm-hmm. But I think the sort of whole image of him and True Detective, especially this season, are, like, conspiring into this, like, weird tornado of bullshit. Of, like... suddenly, wait a second, like, is this maybe just garbage talk? Like, it seems very fancy, and especially last season, it was like, ooh, philosophy, like, this must be a really, like, there's so much to this show. And then, like, maybe there's not, and especially this season, it's like, there's not. There's not yet, certainly. I think that feeling of, like, oh, wow, like, we're really going to dark places. I'm just like... ugh.
No, it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating, and, you know, this is... by no means meant to be an intentional segue from the last segment, but this is true. Second season of True Detective is the kind of show that we were talking about, where it's like there's flashes of intrigue and even some excellence, but then it will just sort of fall on its face, or, you know, stumble or something. It's got a very, very unsteady walk. There are some elements that I like a lot. I mean, I thought that opening sequence
in this third episode,
I thought was wonderful. It was wonderful. It hit my David Lynch sweet spot. Like, I really thought it was great.
We have a clip of that. Let's play that right now. Do you want to explain what's happening in this scene?
Well, Detective Ray was shot at the end of episode two, and we're picking this up, and we think maybe, we don't know exactly what's going on, but he's in a bar. He's in a bar, but it doesn't begin with that. It begins with a shot of, well, we'll just hear it.
Some say love, it is a hunger, an endless aching.
You got your father's hands.
I say love, it is a flower.
My father made me nervous.
Maybe you're already nervous. Maybe you lacked grit.
It's the heart.
I see you. Running through the trees. You're small. The trees are like giants. Men are chasing you.
I'm right here.
You step out the trees. You ain't that fast. Oh, son. They kill you. They shoot you to pieces.
There's this, I believe it's a Conway Twitty impersonator on stage singing, and
yeah.
It's got this very Lynchian feel to it. It was definitely the weirdest scene I think we've seen yet.
It was good. It was good. And I think the musical moments on the show are the ones that come closest to really being truly unusual as opposed to just derivative and what the hell are they going for.
Yeah,
I like
because
that.
No one's talking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once you start hearing the dialogue.
Yeah, like, oh, gotta go.
I feel like they've tried to be funny, but it's fallen flat. I mean, I think it's partly the acting. Like, there was a joke Paul made this episode where he's like, is that a fucking e-cigarette? And, like, little things like that.
That was funny.
It was funny, but it wasn't as funny as I don't know.
It's a tone thing. I've been thinking about this a lot. There were a couple of lines on this episode. One of them is Vince Vaughn's character says, there's no part of my life not overwrought with live or die importance. There's a lot of lines on the show that sound like preemptive criticism of the show you're watching, and that's fine. And then there was another one where his wife says to him, God forgive me for misreading what subtle clues you embed for me in your limp dick.
That was a good line.
It is a good line if it's delivered like it's a line from Deadwood. And I feel like what this show needs is a touch of Deadwood in the delivery.
Yeah.
I'm not saying everybody's got to be wearing cowboy hats and riding horses, but there's something about the cadence of that show. If you read the lines from Deadwood on paper, and if you read a lot of the lines from Justified, if you just looked at them on paper, you might go, that's a bit much. Mm-hmm. It's a bit much. It's a little too, you know.
I was reading some of the
And they're too solemn. They're just too solemn and flat in the way they're reading these lines.
It feels like they've all maybe been instructed to be that way because they all feel the same. Like they're all kind of reining it in. I was reading the comments on our recap this week, and a lot of people were talking about how if we just had like a Christopher Walken, like delivering these lines,
exactly.
It would be perfect.
Exactly. Yeah. And I love the story about how Christopher Walken, every single time that he performs anything, the first thing he does is he takes all of his lines and he rewrites them without any punctuation so that he doesn't have any preconceived notions about what to stress or how to deliver them or any of that stuff. And I feel like all of these actors, I wish we could go back in time and give them that note, like write it out without punctuation and see how it plays. Because I feel like there's too much control being exercised. I'm just guessing here, but I feel like it's like when David Mamet directs his own scripts versus when somebody else does them. Like when David Mamet does it, they often sound like they're reading a ransom note at gunpoint.
Yeah.
But when you get somebody else, like a Glengarry Glenn Ross, then it's fun. Because Al Pacino doesn't sound like Jack Lemmon, who doesn't sound like Kevin Spacey. Everybody sounds like themselves. And here I feel like they're being put through some kind of an I want to be Michael Mann filter, and it's really hurting the show. And I really believe that this show has potential, this second season. There's glimmers of excellence and unusual. They're going for something. It's really going for something, but something is smothering it.
This third episode I liked the most so far, but it's not quite moving. You know, you feel like you said, there's glimmers, but it's being held back by some force.
You know, we talk a lot about texture and sort of like where are we getting like light and shadows, sometimes literally in terms of aesthetics, but sort of like spiritually, like over the course of the episode, like how much do things feel like they're in motion? And I think on a show like Deadwood or in a David Mamet play or movie, like, part of the whole texture, the fiber of it is that it's performative, right? And so that very specific, unnatural dialogue, it gives you as an audience member access to like rawer emotions than you would if people were behaving and talking the way they actually talk, right? So it gives you like a little bit of breathing room within this characters because you're concentrating and you're listening to that, and then you're not babysitting your feelings, right? You're focusing. And so then your feelings have like free reign a little bit more than in just straightforward naturalistic dialogue. And there's plenty of ways to engender emotion on a TV show. There's plenty of ways in storytelling that we get big feelings or big ideas or whatever. But you need to sort of pick and choose where that energy is going and where you want characters to live and where you want your audience's tension to be. Is it between what you know and what they know? Is it between what the two characters who are talking? Is it the difference between what the two of them know? Is it that, like in a horror movie, we often know more than a character, right?
Yes.
And then
yes.
sometimes the tension is we know the same as a character,
suspense,
but there's another
surprise,
character on screen
right.
who knows more, right? Like, mm-hmm. so where is that tension and how does it change over the course, scene to scene, episode to episode? And I just feel like I don't know what the tension is here other than everyone hates themselves.
Right.
And so
right.
in every scene, it's like that's the only thing that is coming
and
through.
There are moments where there should be tension, you would think, like with Annie knowing more about what they want to do with Ray.
But
right.
then he sort of, but
she does
sort of, right? Because he's
right.
like, hey, they're like kind of.
Right,
like,
but it's like a really limp conversation where you don't really get that tension.
Right, but Colin Farrell says to her, like, well, they're like watching me, right? And she's like, oh, I'm not
yeah.
supposed to say anything.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, that's yes.
Yeah,
I wasn't aware that she sounded like Marvin the Martian. But...
No, but like we have that moment. And I think like the sort of banter between the two of them, like I want to like it more because I think
yeah.
there's like
yeah.
there's something to
there's
it.
Potential.
But it's just like, oh, God.
Sometimes when characters have absolutely no sense of humor about themselves, that can be tremendously funny. I keep coming back to that thing about how a lot of this is about delivery. A lot of this is about rhythm. It's about tone. And like, you know, there was another line. I was writing on a lot of these lines here because I wanted to see them on paper. And I wanted to see, is there anything that can be done with these lines? And there was this one line where Vince Vaughn says to Colin Farrell, there's a certain stridency at work. I'm going to put it off to you getting blasted. That's a Deadwood line. If Ian McShane said that line, we would be quoting it right now. You know,
mm-hmm.
but the way he says it, it just doesn't work. It's like they've squeezed the juice out of it. I don't know how this happened.
I mean, I think Vince Vaughn is not doing a good job.
No.
And I'm somebody who, like, I have, like, neutral feelings on him as a performer.
He's done good job in serious
yeah.
roles and in comedic roles.
I just don't think that, like, whatever we're supposed to think about that character is, I have... All I can think of is, like, stop talking.
The scenes with, like...
I like Vince Vaughn. I know I'm in the minority on that, but I think he's the most interesting actor in the cast right now.
I feel like they're not giving him Colin Farrell.
It's because of the position he's been put in.
Yeah. The scenes with his wife in this episode were excruciating.
Well,
she's making performance choices that I do not care for. Well,
that's putting it mildly, yeah.
I mean, I thought it was, like, a bit in the first episode that she was, like, making a joke, and I was like, oh, that's just how your character talks? Like, it seems, like, weird and shticky to me. Although I do think that, like, you know, when she says to him, like, you can suck your own dick or whatever,
yeah.
like, I feel like actually every single scene on this show, it's like how every New Yorker caption can be, Christ, what an asshole. Like, I think
yeah.
every single scene on this show can just be, like, one person saying to the other one, like, suck your own dick. Like, that's the only...
That's the takeaway.
Like, that's the only thing that's happening. And we can just have this, like, Meisner technique back and forth where everyone just says that until it takes on its new meaning. Because what the actual lines are giving us is not... better than that.
Every time I watch this show now, I'm going to picture like a little New Yorker dog
cartoon,
and a
yeah.
caption that says, Christ, what an asshole.
But that, I mean, that's like, I didn't make that up. That's like
no,
an extant
it's
thing.
Really, that's really, it kind of cuts to the heart of it though. As mean as it is, it's very true.
And like, I'm somebody who I love like stylized dialogue, you know?
Yeah.
I get interesting,
no,
I like it.
For me, there's no stupider comment on anything than people don't talk that way. Like, when I hear or read somebody say,
right.
people don't talk that way, I'm like, I'm never going to read or listen to you again because that's just stupid. It's, you know, people don't talk the way they talk in literature, in plays, in movies, nothing. Like, that is the most nothing remark to make. If it doesn't sound right, there's an issue. And let's find out what the issue is. You know,
yeah.
why is it that people don't talk the way they talk in Tarantino? They don't talk the way they talk in Mamet? Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, why? Like, that's what I'm interested in. Why? And the why here, like, I'm not sure that I'm so invested in the show that I want to go all the way to the end of it to figure out why it's not quite working. But it's,
Matt, I believe we're professionally obligated to do that.
It's frustrating. It's frustrating. I kind of, you know, I'm sort of torn between feeling sympathy for the fact that this show is not like everything else on TV, and it's really truly going for something, and it really means what it's trying to do, and the fact that it's just not quite coming off. It's like tantalizingly not there.
The TV show we're discussing is True Detective. You can catch it Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern on HBO. We'll be back to talk about Orange is the New Black in a moment, but first, a word from our sponsor. We're sponsored this week by Hulu, where you can now stream every episode of Seinfeld. My favorite Seinfeld moment would have to be the episode where Seinfeld chooses being able to say hello over the girl he's seeing.
That's pretty good. I think my favorite is less than a moment and more like an ongoing thing, but I feel like Seinfeld validated my deep hatred for the movie The English Patient.
I remember Elaine.
Yeah, because Elaine hated it too, and I felt like so vindicated, and I feel like a real kindred spirit there, because I just hate that movie.
I think I'm torn between the movie phone. When Kramer became movie phone, he said, why don't you just tell me the name of the movie you want to see? And of course, everybody chooses it, but I think the all-time great for me is, I'm out!
For the first time ever, you can stream all episodes of Seinfeld exclusively on Hulu. For $7.99 a month, watch all 9 seasons of Seinfeld and so many other shows on all of your supported devices with your Hulu subscription on Hulu.com. So this week we're discussing the second half of Orange is the New Black's 3rd season. This was a really complicated season with we got a lot of stories of characters we hadn't seen before, like Leanne. We found out she was Amish. Faith was a big theme. Black Cindy becomes Jewish. Norma becomes a prophet in the prison. And motherhood is also playing out throughout with Alita and Daya, their relationship. And then there were also a ton of darker storylines with Soso's suicide attempt, the bigotry towards Sophia, and what I thought was most interesting was Pensatucky's rape. How did you think it handled tackling all these big subjects?
Shockingly well, considering how much was going on. And I was a little shocked, actually, at how much incident was packed into this season and how well it was handled. Like, there weren't really any parts of it that I felt like I was getting too much or too little. Like, the sense of balance seemed just about right. And also the way that this is something the show has always been good at, but the way that it pivots from really broad comedy to really kind of upsetting drama and back again. It's so hard to do that and not feel like you're trying too hard. Like you're
so
trying
unusual.
Too hard.
Yeah. Are there any other shows you can think of that have done that kind of
thing? At the moment, no. Mm-hmm. But there are times when the show makes me think of Six Feet Under. Mm-hmm. Six Feet Under used to do that. Six Feet Under was a stitch. That was a really, truly funny show. And it was also an incredibly dark, at times, very melodramatic show. And then it would go back and be kind of silly again.
I mean, obviously Weeds, too, I think, has some super, super dark parts of it.
Yeah.
Like, there's, like, extended torture scenes in Weed. I mean, it's very violent. And you know, I think sort of part of Jenji Kohan's, like, calling card is that ability to blend different tones and different ideas and still make it all feel like everyone's on the same show. You know, I think that's something the show does extremely well, given how wide a net it casts in terms of how many characters there are, how many different sort of states of being there are in terms of, like, full-on panic, settled in. Like, I'm on the top of the food chain, I'm at the bottom of the food chain, right? We have a lot of points on this map, but it's very clearly the same map. I think that's something that other shows don't even get close to.
We mentioned this the last time, but I want to bring it up again, which is MASH. I think MASH is the show that really showed audiences and TV as a whole that it was possible to do a show like this. That you could have, you know, somebody dying on the operating table and people railing against God and the universe and the war, and then you can turn around and, like, somebody's stealing somebody's panties. You know, you can do that. But you have to be really, really good at what you do, but you can do that. And I think this show proves it again.
Did you find one storyline particularly compelling this season?
I loved Leanne's flashback episode.
I really...
One of the things that really drew me to the show in the first 2 seasons was how often it surprised me with the people's backstories. That's part of why I didn't love Boo's flashback episode, because it felt so unsurprising. It just felt very like a traditional story that we'd heard a lot. And I like seeing everyone as something you totally didn't expect. You know, finding out, you know, like Lorna's credit card stuff, you think that she's in jail for
that
credit card stuff, but then it's not that, right? So, like, sort of getting to the bottom of everyone's story. And we still don't know. It's possible that Boo's story does have a strange turn and we don't know what she's incarcerated for. But I thought Leanne's story was just really gave us this, like, depth. I mean, same with Pensatucky. This, like, real, like, twisted depth to what had been like so villainized and demonized in the early seasons. You know, Panzatucky was the main antagonist in season one.
One of the main ones.
You know, season one ends with, it seems like either she kills Piper or Piper kills her. Like, that's what that season was like swirling towards. And so to have in this season her seem, you know, totally non-threatening. And then also we have this like real, like, you know, agony of her experience. I thought that was handled really beautifully.
Something they do with her story, and they do it with a lot of the characters, which is these characters carry themselves with such bravado a lot of the time. And then there's a moment where they show you the terror that's right underneath that. And I felt like this particular storyline did that beautifully. I actually have here, I brought into the studio with me my notes from watching this second half of the season, and I've got, I guess, 12 or 13 double-sided note cards, and they're just covered with lines and moments. Like, I can't even choose. There's so many good ones, and there's big ones, and there's small ones, but there's just so many. And I
can
love...
Can you share a couple?
Yeah, like, well, Red and Healy. I love Red and Healy. Their whole story, the arc of their whole story. I was surprised, I'm consistently surprised that I'm able to feel anything for Healy at all, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and I really like him, and then suddenly I remind myself of what a miserable, rotten son of a bitch he is in so many ways.
But he's still a human who feels
things.
He's
still a human who feels things. And that line when Red says to him, "Can I go now that I've watered your ego flower?"
Yeah, yeah.
That was great. Yeah. And the whole business with the Norma cult sort of growing and ebbing, and the subtle way that they weave that in with all the talk of faith and Judaism and Christianity, and it even ties in with Suzanne when she's writing her fiction, and there's this great line. It's really a great little bit where suddenly her stories are so popular that people are writing fan fiction, and she's talking about how fan fiction. What does she say here? She thinks the fan fiction is devaluing her actual fiction, and at one point she describes, fan fiction, she says, kind of like the New Testament. Am I right? I love the idea of the New Testament as fan fiction is great. That's really,
that's
truly funny. Yeah, and yeah, she says fan fiction is cheapening my legacy.
I think all of these like sort of funny moments, but I think is why the dark moments like pack such a wallop is the sort of magical thinking and the desire for like really extreme fiction, right? Because like those things are at their core because our characters are living in really dehumanizing, really horrible conditions. And so, of course, they're drawn to magical thinking. They're grieving the lives they're not leading. Of course, they're looking for this, like, extreme fiction Suzanne is writing. They're so bored. Like,
the rules are arbitrary, and they're hard. They're immutable, and they're inescapable.
So we've seen most of our characters in flashback have, like, some sort of trauma or survival. Living in the conditions they're living in is itself traumatizing.
Yes.
Right? The kind of capricious threats they're constantly under, like, they fear for physical safety with good reason from both guards and fellow inmates. The threat of Shu is permanent, and that itself is psychological torture. So even though we have these like funny or weird or like quirky things, they're all like centered on and anchored by this like real horrible truth of their existence in this cult. Like in this moment, like however much they are able to express themselves and their ideas, it's all trapped by the fact that they're incarcerated.
Yeah, and also the arbitrary and capricious nature of the way power is exercised on this show. Like that's something like that's part of this tradition that I feel like it's connected to, like Catch 22, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, things like that. A lot of Vonnegut. You feel that's one of the reasons why I think you feel sympathy for the inmates, but also sympathy for the guards. And there's always, you know, to quote the worst Star Wars film, there's always a bigger fish. You know, like you get to the top of the food chain, what you think is the top of the food chain with somebody like Caputo, but you also see how he has to answer to people. And their whims are often hard to determine, and they seem unfair or stupid a lot of the time.
I think that's sort of exemplified by Mike Birbiglia's character, right?
So yeah.
when they do that like personality test, and Caputo's like, he's like, oh, we don't even grade that. Like, no, but that way, you know, it diverts the frustration. It's like, well, there must be some system. It's like, there's not.
Right.
Like, this is just a way to sort of coerce people. And it's, on the one hand, like, sort of brilliant.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, like, really horrifying.
Really, really scary.
Because we saw how seriously everyone was taking this. And,
yes.
And, you know, like, any sort of moment of reprieve, any break from this, like, really distressing monotony, any kind of opportunity feels like such a chance. And so to watch that be sort of a point of, like, really casual manipulation on his part, even though his character, you sort of feel for then at the end when it's like, oh, you're working for your dad.
Yeah.
And so, like, you have your own weird crap where he's like,
yes.
Well, let's just, like, go get her. Like, we can just get in a car and go. And you're just like, oh, God, you don't know anything about this, do you? And I think the sort of over the course of the season, we see a lot of like real tension and confusion about like what goes into running a prison, like right. what is a good idea for running a prison, you know, let alone like is prison a good idea in the first place?
Yeah,
which is not a given.
It's a valid question, and they actually broach it on the show.
Yeah,
what did you guys think about Piper's new gangster kind of persona and her relationship with Aussie?
It seemed, within the context of this show and what we know about Piper, believable. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't like all of a sudden she was Edward James Olmos in American Me. You know, it's like within the framework of this show, what's happening is believable. And this idea of selling, you know, these panties. What was the line? Was it Piper's brother who says, this shit is artisanal? That
I
was
mean,
great.
I liked aspects of that storyline, although I think what's strange is that this is the second, like, selling used panty story that's been on TV in the last couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Younger had a storyline about it, too.
Yeah.
And it always feels sort of, like, phony baloney to me. Not that I don't think people sell underwear. Of course they do. But I feel like they were overstating, perhaps, how...
marketable it
yeah,
was?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, I mean, I'll confess that I am not an expert in the used panties economy. So maybe this is my own naivete showing. That said, like, I, you know, one of the things we know about Piper is that she is entrepreneurial. Right. She had her own business.
And we see her able to work the system where yeah. no one else can.
Yeah. We also know that she's like pretty selfish. She's pretty ruthless. Mm-hmm.
She's creative.
Yeah.
She's creative in working around these constraints that we've been talking about. She's smart about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she thinks outside the box, as they say. I love this. Also, just the sense of beauty on the show. I don't think the show gets enough credit for its lyrical tendencies. And there's so many moments on the show that are almost verging on too muchness, but they're beautiful for that reason. Like the wedding ceremony where, you know, lines from Foreigner are quoted. You know, that's just great.
That was amazing.
That was really, really great.
I did not love the story, like how Bennett wound up leaving. That was
yeah,
the part
that
I
felt a little.
It was like, oh, go have fun on How to Get Away with Murder.
Yeah.
But that part I didn't quite buy.
Well, it felt like they could have done it in a more organic way where it would have made sense that he was leaving, you know, like. Of course, it's believable that this situation would overwhelm him and he would not want to deal with it, but not for his character and not at that moment.
There was an interview with that actor that I read where it seemed like he was trying very hard to be diplomatic about the fact that it didn't make a whole lot of sense to him either.
That was the one real sticking point I had this season where I was like, oh, that part I don't.
He seemed like he really cared.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So it didn't really jibe. That's true. There were some other little moments here and there that I didn't think were quite what I wanted them to be, but it's such a bounty of riches overall that I don't really care.
I think one thing that this show, I hesitate to say struggle because it's not quite that, but because there are so many characters, I think it sometimes can be, you can feel very much like, oh gosh, we haven't seen Tasty in like 3 episodes, right? Or
yeah.
Like this season I felt very much like, wow, we're really not getting a lot of Sophia at all.
Right.
You know, and certainly like some characters are much more in the forefront than they were last season, like Cindy, for example, but then, you know, at the expense of, it's like, oh, we didn't really see that much of Poussey. We saw her sorta, mm-hmm. but we didn't get like a huge arc for her. And like, I really miss Nikki. Like, I love
Nikki.
Yeah. I love that
she
character.
She was one of the best.
And so we just had like, you know, we didn't see that much of the golden oldies.
She'll be back.
I hope so. Like, sure.
But the season ends too with all these new women entering. Yeah. So is it just going to become more splintered in that way? I don't know.
They could cycle them in and out. But in a way, this is, okay, and again, nutty comparison, but we're kind of, if we keep going with the show, we're going to hit the Glee problem, which is, you know, how many years can you stare at the same cast of characters? And it is an institution. People are going to be cycling in and out. They've been bringing in new characters very sparingly up to this point. But at some point, they're going to have to cycle more people out and more people in if the show is going to have long-term prospects. Like, mm-hmm. it could conceivably, because it is an institutional show, you know, it could be a show that runs forever. You know, it could, and as depressing as that sounds, considering that it's about a prison, prisons have always been with us, and conceivably there, you know, we could get to the point where not even Piper's on the show, you know?
Yeah, I could see that.
But it's a real risk, because who do you cycle in and who do you cycle out? Who are you going to pay attention to? And there's always that sort of like donor rejection that happens with the audience where it's like, I don't like this character. They're not the characters that I'm used to.
Right. That's it for this week's Vulture TV podcast. I'll be out next week, but you can catch Margaret and Matt right here. And feel free to email us any questions or comments at tvquestions@vulture.com in the meantime. Our producer is Sarah Abdurrahman. Our senior producer is Laura Mayer. Andy Bowers is our executive producer. The Vulture TV podcast is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. If you like the show, please be sure to tell a friend and subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to leave us a rating or comment wherever you subscribe. I'm Gazelle Amami, and you can find me on Twitter at Gazellephant.
I'm Margaret Lyons, and you can find me on Twitter at MarginCharge.
I'm Matt Soller Seitz. You can find me on Twitter as Matt Soller Seitz.
Thanks for listening.
Oh, dear. There was some fucked up psychology in that place before it became a murder scene. There's a certain stridency at work. Oh. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, we didn't even get to talk about the weird sex swing. In the foyer?
Sex swing.
But it was just like, open the front door. Like, it's like, what the hell? Like, put it upstairs. My God. It was just like, oh, here's my living room. This is where I keep my animal masks and my sex swing.
Right, right.
Ugh, it doesn't make sense.